First, I'd like to read you something that Dylan Thomas said. When I first began to read nursery rhymes for myself, and later to read other verses and ballads, I knew I had discovered the most important things that could be ever. There they were, seemingly lifeless, made only of black and white, but out of them, out of their own being, came love and terror and pity and pain and wonder and all the other vague abstractions that made our ephemeral lives dangerous, great, and bearable. End quote. Poets are in love with words. One way to describe poetry is to say that it is language at its best. Another is to say it's language that is original, memorable, and has some sort of pattern. I'd add that poetry is writing that grabs you by the throat and won't let go, either because the sense of it or the sound of the word sticks in your mind, usually both, working together as the poet helps us to feel what he or she is feeling. Here, for instance, is a tiny poem by W.S. Merwin that could have been written especially for me, I felt. It's called Separation. Your absence has gone through me like thread through a needle. Everything I do is stitched with its color. Of course, loss of one kind or another is a major theme in so many poems. Today, for instance, of the poems chosen by our readers because they're poems they especially like, there are two. The first reader is Ruth.
I'm going to read an interpretation by Ezra Pound of a Chinese poem written by Li Po in the 9th century and subsequently translated into English. It is a letter from a river merchant's wife to her husband. While my hair was still cut straight across my forehead, I played about the front gate, pulling flowers. You came by on bamboo stilts, playing horse. You walked about my seat, playing with blue plums. And we went on living in the village of Chokan, two small people, without dislike or suspicion. At 14, I married my lord, you. I never laughed, being bashful. Lowering my head, I looked at the wall. Called to 1,000 times, I never looked back. At 15, I stopped scowling. I desired my dust to be mingled with yours forever and forever and forever. Why should I climb the lookout? At 16, you departed. You went into far Kutoyen by the river of swirling eddies. And you have been gone 5 months. The monkeys make sorrowful noise overhead. You dragged your feet when you went out. By the gate now, the moss is grown, the different mosses too deep to clear them away. The leaves fall early this autumn in wind. The paired butterflies are already yellow with August over the grass in the west garden. They hurt me. I grow older. If you are coming down through the narrows of the River Kiang, please let me know beforehand, and I will come out to meet you as far as Chofu Sa.
This is a poem called Eden Rock by Charles Causley, who is a contemporary British poet. They are waiting for me, somewhere beyond Eden Rock. My father, 25, In the same suit of genuine Irish tweed, his terrier Jack, still 2 years old and trembling at his feet. My mother, 23, in a sprig dress drawn at the waist, ribbon in her straw hat, has spread the stiff white cloth over the grass. Her hair, the colour of wheat, takes on the light. She pours tea from a thermos, the milk straight from an old HP sauce bottle, a screw of paper for a cork. Slowly sets out the same three plates, the tin cups painted blue. The sky whitens as if lit by three suns. My mother shades her eyes and looks my way over the drifted stream. My father spins a stone along the water. Leisurely, they beckon to me from the other bank. I hear them call. See where the stream path is. Crossing is not as hard as you might think. I had not thought that it would be like this.
The beauty of nature is another thing, of course, that motivates poets to write. This morning, the sun broke my window and came in laughing. Those are Javier Galvez's words. When I first read them, I wondered if perhaps the advertising copywriter who came up with Mummy, You're Making the Windows Laugh for the Windex commercial had stolen that idea from Galvez, or more likely the copywriter was a poet as well. I'd like to read you what Robert Frost, that ever so popular American poet, said about poetry. You will remember stopping by woods on a snowy evening and mending wall and the road not taken. All those people that love poetry will have read those. As a sometime writer of poems, I found what Frost has to say particularly useful. Here it is. Like a piece of ice on a hot stove, a poem must ride on its own melting. A poem may be worked over once it is in being, but may not be worried into being. Its most precious quality will remain its having run itself and carried the poet away with it. Read it 100 times, it will forever keep its freshness. It can never lose its sense of a meaning that once unfolded by surprise as it went. That is from The Figure a Poem Makes by Robert Frost, which he wrote in 1939. I plan to go to the library and see if I can find that. A good poem can set your teeth on edge, or it can melt your heart with its beauty and its tenderness. Consider this one by British poet Robin Robertson for its pure terror. Law of the Island. They lashed him to old timbers that would barely float, with weights at the feet so that only his face was out of the water. Over his mouth and eyes they tied 2 live mackerel with twine and pushed him out from the rocks. They stood then, smoking cigarettes and watching the sky, waiting for a gannet to read that flecks of silver from 100 feet up, close its wings and plummet dive. I don't know if you noticed all the I sounds in there. Eyes, tide, live, twine, sky, dive. Like a continuous mouthing of disbelief at the horror. Carlos Fuentes, another Latin American writer, said, writing is a struggle against silence. And Maxine Kuman, who is a contemporary American poet, tells us, the person who writes out of an inner need is trying to order his corner of the universe. Very often the meaning of an experience or an emotion becomes clear only in that way. In other words, poets don't necessarily know what they're going to write until they write it. I certainly find that to be true. I write to find out what I think or what I feel. And sometimes it's pretty surprising. So our next readers are Danielle Walker and Alistair Mott, who are reading their own poems. Danielle?
Hi. This piece was written originally to indicate where dangerous seeds are sown in interpersonal relationship skills, which is childhood. Now I read it as a poem of concern about my task of motherhood and not repeating this pattern for my daughter Bronwyn. It's called 1976 Chevrolet Malibu. On the highway, the hood up, exposing a wide, unknown territory of hoses and steel spewing smoke, Mom wiped her brow to hide her tears. She let me take care of my sister in her car seat behind me while she ran for water to cool the rad. My baby cried as we drove home. Mom stared ahead at the wide Alberta orange sunset. In the garage doorway with bare feet and lips stained Smarties red-brown, I watched Dad decode viscous black mysteries like displacement and air-to-fuel ratios with patience. As he forced a socket, twisting the ratchet with hands that could crush my neck, Mom grabbed my shoulder, hissing, "Get inside where it's civilized."
This morning is a reflection of a part of my life where I did a lot of dancing. And so basically, this poem entitled "The Dance Floor" is dedicated to all the ladies that made life worthwhile. I enter the room. Soft lights touch my being. My senses feel out who's present. Like a creeping plant, multitude of notes affect my senses. An awareness of others around, visions of women touch me. As the music develops, my being becomes enhanced. What sense of mystery? What woman will be the one to be? My body aches for expression. Awareness of potential arises. My eyes scan the room. Her eyes reach out with meaning onto the dance floor. Tentative touching occurs. Two creatures in motion. A bond of meaning, more emotional sensing, physical creation on the dance floor. Man and woman in concert, but separate. Connected, but alone. Expressing what is on the dance floor. We become enveloped in the moment. The dance becomes us. Instinctive, deep passions arise. We are suddenly alone on the dance floor. Tentative becomes abandonment. Our very beings find expression from our souls. Two creatures creating melodies on the floor. We are alone. Togetherness identifies our moment. Our bodies listen in unison to the beat of our hearts, intertwined with the pulsating rhythms on the dance floor. Feet express in dizzying patterns, like lovers exchanging intimacies. Weave explore, expressing within all the emotions between us, a brief moment of spirituality on the dance floor.
Personal poems like these are called lyric poems, as you probably know, named after the lyre or small harp that the poets of Greece played as they recited their verse. That's as opposed to epic poems, the kind poets in earlier cultures wrote to convey values or traumas or deeds of derring do. Next, we have two poems that are concerned about our inner lives. They're subtle, not immediately obvious.
This poem was written about 660 years ago by Hafiz, the great Sufi master and perhaps the most beloved poet in Persia. His poems portray him as an exuberant man who exalted in a god he saw in many guises: innkeeper, painter, flute. This poem is not about his notions of God. I like this poem because it reminds me sharply that a segment of society which condemns cruelty to animals has been around for centuries, perhaps millennia, long, long before the SPCA was formed 100 years ago. The poem is titled Two Bears. Two Bears. Once, after a hard day's forage, two bears sat together in silence on a beautiful vista, watching the sun go down and feeling deeply grateful for life. Though after a while, a thought-provoking conversation began, which turned on the topic of fame. The one bear said, "Did you hear about Rustum? He has become famous and travels from city to city in a golden cage. He performs to hundreds of people who laugh and applaud his carnival stunts." The other bear thought for a few seconds, then started weeping.
Good morning. I'm Anastasia Sidor. I'm fairly new here. And I'm going to be reading Moonlight by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. I first came across this poem in 2006 when I was on the worship committee at Westwood Unitarian Congregation in Edmonton. And it was the full moon and I was looking for a reading and I absolutely fell in love with this. As a pale phantom with a lamp ascends some ruin's haunted stair, so glides the moon along the damp, mysterious chambers of the air. Now hidden in cloud, and now revealed as if this phantom, full of pain, were by the crumbling walls concealed, and at the windows seen again. Until at last, serene and proud, in all the splendor of her light, she walks the terraces of clouds, supreme as empress of the night. I look, but recognize no more objects familiar to my view. The very pathway to my door is an enchanted avenue. All things are changed, one mass of shade. The elm trees drop their curtains down. By palace, park, and colonnade, I walk as if in a foreign town. The very ground beneath my feet is clothed with a diviner air. White marble paves the silent street and glimmers in the empty square. Illusion. Underneath there lies the common life of every day. Only the spirit glorifies with its own tints the sober gray. In vain we look, in vain uplift our eyes to heaven if we are blind. We see but what we have the gift of seeing. What we bring, we find.
As I said earlier, nature is always a writing trigger for poets. Reverence for nature makes us know our place in the order of things. So Claire will now read a poem by Mary Oliver.
I suspect a lot of you need no introduction to the poetry of Mary Oliver. She is one of America's best-loved poets. It has been said of her, she writes clear and poignant observances of the natural world with unadorned language and accessible themes. I think my first attraction to her poetry was because it is so accessible. You know what she is talking about, and you can relate. She said in an interview, "If I have any lasting worth, it will be because I tried to make people remember what the earth is meant to look like. I don't mean the world is all great and wonderful. My emphasis is on the good and hopeful." She does find the world beautiful, and her writing makes it unforgettable. So this is Black Oaks by Mary Oliver. Okay, not one can write a symphony or a dictionary or even a letter to an old friend full of remembrance and comfort. Not one can manage a single sound, though the blue jays carp and whistle all day in the branches without the push of the wind. But to tell the truth, after a while, I'm pale with longing for their thick bodies ruckled with lichen. And you can't keep me from the woods, from the tonnage of their shoulders and their shining green hair. Today is like any other, 24 hours, a little sunshine, a little rain. "Listen," says Ambition, nervously shifting her weight from one boot to another. "Why don't you get going?" For there I am in the mossy shadows under the trees. And to tell the truth, I don't want to let go of the wrists of idleness. I don't want to sell my life for money. I don't even want to come in out of the rain.
And now we have a poem that certainly resonates with me, and I think will resonate with all us silver-headed ones.
This poem is by Billy Collins, who's a contemporary American poet, and I like what he says about the poem. This seems to be a poem that anyone over 30 has an immediate grasp of, and anyone over 40 or 50 has an intense fondness for. It's called Forgetfulness. The name of the author is the first to go, followed obediently by the title, the plot, the heartbreaking conclusion, the entire novel, which suddenly becomes one you have never read, never even heard of. It is as if, one by one, the memories you used to harbour decided to retire to the southern hemisphere of the brain, to a little fishing village where there are no phones. Long ago, you kissed the names of the nine muses goodbye and watched the quadratic equation pack its bag. And even now, as you memorize the order of the planets, something else is slipping away. A state flower, perhaps. The address of an uncle. The capital of Paraguay. Whatever it is you are struggling to remember, it's not poised on the tip of your tongue, not even lurking in some obscure corner of your spleen. It has floated away down a dark, mythological river whose name begins with an L, as far as you can recall. Well on your own way to oblivion, where you will join those who have even forgotten how to swim and how to ride a bicycle. No wonder you rise in the middle of the night to look up the date of a famous battle in a book on war. No wonder the moon in the window seems to have drifted out of a love poem that you used to know by heart.
Didn't I? Billy Collins is another poet like Mary Oliver who writes very accessible poems, and they're deceptively simple when you actually really analyze them. They're very tightly worked together, crafted, very tightly crafted. He has one about, it's called Victoria's Secret. You should look up. I bet if you Google it, you can get it online. It's about the girls in the Victoria's Secret catalog, and it's very funny. Our last reader is Sue Ellen, who's bringing us the wisdom of Emily Dickinson.
I first met Emily Dickinson when I was a teenager, and it was a poem that I was just struck with the turn of phrase. She says, "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there's a pair of us? Don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring bog." So from that first introduction, I didn't really remember her name, but when I came across her again, I really fell in love with her poetry. And she's an American poet who lived in the 1800s. She wrote 1,775 poems, and none of them were published during her lifetime. They were too odd. They didn't rhyme. She didn't use the conventions of poetry. In her later years, she became an eccentric recluse. She dressed only in white. She never left her house. And when the neighborhood children came to visit, she would lower cookies on a string from an upstairs window. When she was eventually published, about 10 years after her death, then she was described as a wholly new and original poetic genius. So her poems are not melodic. They're not always the best ones to hear this way, because they use unusual ways to describe things, but I'm going to give it a go. I've chosen the poem "Hope is a Thing with Feathers," and Anne asked me why I chose this. Some of you know that my husband and I lived in the north. Our lives were very interesting, but not especially prosperous, and there were times when hope is what I really clung to. And for my birthday one year, my ex-husband made me a pen and ink drawing of a broken stone wall with a little bird singing on the top. And then he wrote two of the verses of this poem, and I still have that. I know this one by heart. I say it to myself often when I need hope. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.